Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is from the Toronto International Film Festival, and I'm talking about the movies that are here and only here, or maybe here and I haven't talked about them yet. And I'm very happy to be embarking on this with Mr. Mark Ash.
Hello, listeners. Hello, Nick. Hello, listeners. Hello to all of you out there listening along. Maybe you're running in the. Maybe you're running through the park as I do, listening to this podcast. Maybe you're driving to visit your parents. Maybe you're in the supermarket, but wherever you are, it's lovely to be inside your ear canal.
Well, where do we begin? I mean, do you want to say, should we say something like general about the festival, that it's like a little quiet maybe?
It's a little quiet because it's very, well, this is the strike tiff, famously.
Yes, that is the key.
That is a key thing. Yeah. Although, because, and this is something we'll get into a little bit, because obviously so many films at TIFF are star-driven adult award season contenders or pretenders, that there is a huge impetus upon the kinds of actors who whose presence can get a movie greenlit and find a movie its audience and ensure its distribution and create a certain amount of buzz and excitement here at the Toronto Film Festival, which is so deeply enmeshed in the everyday fabric of a city in a way that's unique from my limited experience of festival travel, but is also probably unique just actually, not just in my naive opining. And then so there have been fewer of the crushes of people in the rush line outside of the Princess of Wales hoping to get a glimpse of, well, Taylor Swift last year, who could be right, who is not on strike, but that is the first name that came to mind. There is less of a, you won't see any of the cast at a party for the most part.
Right. I always end up in a revolving door at some point with passing an actor, which is a little too cinematic. But honestly, it has happened.
And yet we have so many actors here as directors.
True, yeah. There are quite a few actor-director movies. I don't know, Anna Kendrick, Ethan Hawke, Viggo Mortensen.
Chris Pine. Finn Wolfhard of Stranger Things.
Yeah.
They're all double threats.
They are, and they're all...
Well, triple threats, because Finn Wolfhard's band played on Festival Street yesterday afternoon.
Oh, all right. Yeah, they're all, I think, wisely preparing themselves, so they will always have some sort of work.
Multiple revenue streams. Get on that grind.
That's right,
Finn Wolfhard.
Well, just to throw things off, since maybe listeners are expecting the Toronto titles, for example, directed by actor directors, I wanted to start with Miyazaki,
the highly anticipated Hayao Miyazaki, and The Boy and the Heron.
The Boy and the Heron, which as soon as I saw it, I began to get on my Twitter feed pictures of herons.
That's so nice.
Yeah.
It is a beautiful, it is a beautifully rendered heron.
It is. Yeah.
Maybe we could just, I mean, I think that having sort of immersed myself a little bit, having dipped, waded up to my knees in Miyazaki's work from the 80s up to today.
And in preparation for this
film, the last month or so, not seeing remotely everything, but making sure that he was fresh in my mind, I think that I've seen a lot of birds, I've seen a lot of flying things, and there are a couple of different types of animals in Miyazaki films, sort of all of which we see in this. There are there are sort of multiplied, unpersonified, like flocks of birds, like pelicans in this one, that are sort of, because so many people, animals, supernatural beings, so many things in Miyazaki's films are personified in interesting ways. Mm-hmm. It's very disconcerting when you see a number of animals that all look alike and don't have the power of human speech, and they all swarm you. And so there's elements of that. There's elements of the way that the heron sort of swallows something, and you can see it go all the way down its body, and you have that wonderful sort of the outlines of all of the creatures, and then you have just the miracle of flight, all of which is rendered with these beautiful sound design, thumping, just whooshing, thumping wings, sort of flying away from you. All of which is to say that this is a very hard movie to describe its plot. So I'm just describing the senses first, because
yes,
I think it's
memory.
Because it's such a rich and sort of career summarizing sensory experience for him, as it is plot-wise, but in a way that's maybe harder. When we do the plot summary, it will feel very much like being at a breakfast table with a small nephew who is telling you about the dream that he had.
Right.
And
yeah.
Everything changed, and locations change, beings change,
yeah.
Motivations change. It's almost sort of exquisite corpsey.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely opens up a whole other world about halfway through or so. But I mean, I guess the starting point, just in case you think this is some sort of, you know, like a boy and his pet heron or something like that, and they just hang out and he learns the miracle of flight and telling the truth or something. It's a boy whose father remarries. So, you know, staple of cartoons, the bereft child. And they move to the country, basically. But what's more important is that it's a house that's next to this very mysterious tower structure.
Very like Kes, I thought.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. And, yeah, the tower contains multitudes of creatures. But what happens is that a heron, who from the get-go, I have to say, immediately it feels like it's a metaphor for death. Then you realize it's almost not just that, because, yeah, the heron is one of the creatures that transforms, which introduces a whole other world. I totally agree that actually trying to chronicle what happens after that will just sound like
we're making it up.
But I think that's a key thing for the movie for me, which is that, I mean, let's say like a Lynch movie, say, is dreamlike, or a Buñuel movie is dreamlike in kind of associative ways. But in terms of a movie that actually feels, has that kind of combination of being like hyper alert and of course also like not there that a dream can be, it's hard for me to think a lot of filmmakers who do that more than Miyazaki. Not even that he's trying to, like someone like Lynch is obviously trying to hook the big fish or reel in the big fish.
Which does happen in this movie.
It's true. I couldn't even explain the cause and effect in this movie, but the key thing is that there's this other world, parallel world, where, yeah, creatures sort of hold sway. Other versions of people exist. And it's sort of the child navigating these two worlds and navigating his emotions.
There are a number of obvious references to or echoes of particularly European fairy tales in it. Mm-hmm. But
yeah.
One element in particular is there's a moment in early in the film before the boy has gone into this dreamy netherworld where he's trying to get into the tower, and the tower's been blocked off, but there is a little bit of an entryway that he's trying to squeeze himself through to chase the heron up the turret, but the opening is too small or he's too big, and it's this obvious, and you're thinking, right, yes, he's too old, he's about, you know, 12 or so, it
right.
seems like, and it's that moment where you become too similar to, you can't see Totoro anymore. It's the metaphor for the elusiveness and ephemerality of the childhood world, which then is odd, but except that it happens before he then goes to that world. But there is a sense, similarly, of this netherworld that is accessible only to children, where time works differently, and mm-hmm. which is also a reprieve specifically from the Second World War when the film takes place. So I'm obviously mm-hmm. working towards this being a Narnia thing, in which, similarly, the politics of the kingdom are quite diffuse. There are warring legions of different creatures. There are sort of independent-minded pirates.
Yes.
But similarly to the C.S. Lewis book, it is quite morally instructive, I think, The Boy and the Heron. We should mention, of course, the film's Japanese title is How Do You Live?
Yeah.
Which is a book from the 1930s that is structured as a dialogue or an epistolary dialogue between a precocious 15-year-old boy and his worldly uncle, who has taken an interest in him. And the boy is recording his impressions of the world and how politics and economies and morality and human interactivity and society works. And the uncle is noting his observations and correcting him and guiding him and mentoring him. And I don't know, it's interesting because so many, I think, we live in New York and we know that the IFC Center has Miyazaki matinees pretty much constantly because it's the kind of film, I think, that like a lot of people our age, younger, cannot wait to have kids so that they can show them Studio Ghibli movies. And there is such a hope in, I think there is such a hope in intergenerational arts transfer that this art that you love which is usually made by Hayao Miyazaki, will mean exactly to your child what it meant to you, and will shape them in the same unpredictable but very definitive ways that it shaped you. And that's a sort of interesting metatext for this movie, in which is based on a book about intergenerational knowledge, transfer of knowledge and values,
yeah.
and which also does involve the kid finding his dead mother's copy of How Do You Live?
Yes.
And right. then going to this child netherworld, where he encounters various mentor figures and is tasked with becoming, I don't know, something like a sorcerer's apprentice.
Yeah, and this with the, I mean, since you mentioned sorcerer's apprentice, with the same feeling of chaos always on the verge of being unleashed, or forces greater than you. And while you were talking, I was trying to figure out why a movie like this is, because so many cartoons with children protagonists are structured as like journeys or this sort of thing, or some sort of voyage or self-realization, and how, like, maybe it is a dreamlike quality, because again, you're sort of in control but not in control when you're moving through a dream, and that feeling of that feels more true to life somehow, because it's partly about how much agency and understanding you really have as a child.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's also just gorgeous. It feels so lived in there. I couldn't keep track of all these throwaway shots along the way. And it's almost sometimes the throwaway shots that make a movie feel more real, because it's like the documentary part of a movie where it's just, we didn't pay a lot of attention to this, but you can tell it's real because it's not the main thing. So, but for, there's this one moment where they indicate that it's turning from day to night by like a lily closing. Do you remember that?
Mm.
And the water is this iridescent color, and the shot lasts for less than a second, you know, and it's the movie is just full of that.
It is a late film. I mean, it's easy to say that because we know how old he is.
But he's been making late films
for a while. Yeah.
He's like Godard or something. It's like a constant late phase.
But this, The Wind Rises was a very late, 10 years ago was a very late film too. But this feels very self-summarizing in ways that are really rewarding.
It's important to say.
I would say that it seems like the visual style has elements of both Ghibli's pre-digital and digital eras. I think that a lot of the backdrops, I think, are painted and have strikingly little, especially in the first third of the movie. Mm-hmm. There's some stuff with some frames in it that have almost no movement in them, and you don't see the wind blowing through the grass. You see just the sort of Monet-like green daubs of leaves in a way that reminds you that it used to be much harder for mm-hmm. Ghibli's animators to create movement across more than one plane within a single cell, and how that's changed so much, and you see it change over the course of the film. So in some ways, it feels, even visually, in addition to all of the echoes that you can find, I think we should say that it's about a child going on a magical quest to in some way make his family whole again, which is very Spirited Away, but there's also elements of Totoro. The father works in...
He's a factory owner, I think.
Yes, he's an industrialist who appears to be to make components for Japanese fighter jets, which there's a scene of them unloading cockpits. That was the Miyazaki family business. That is what Miyazaki's dad did. He did make components for the Mitsubishi Zero.
Hmm.
And it feels in some ways like a film that refracts back on so much of what he's done already that it's hard to say that this is, I mean, ranking it is, I will let my more dedicated anime fans decide, but it's hard to, it's hard to place it in a hierarchy of its films because it's hard to rank it vertically because it feels so horizontal. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I think I know what you mean. Yeah. I just want to mention that it's a pretty funny movie as you know, spooky as it can get. It's also pretty
the parakeets
funny. I didn't even want to say it because it's such, for me, I didn't know anything about the movie. And I had, even though this movie, I guess, came out in Japan like 2 months ago, I hadn't read anything about it. So that,
yeah.
That the particular horde of animals that appears are great. But maybe we can turn our attention from The Boy and the Heron to...
one of those star-driven movies for adults that Tiff loves so well.
Yes, for example.
Because that's what everybody came... That's why everybody comes to Tiff, is the hope that they will see the next movie that they will someday rediscover on, like, that the future generations will look at the Wikipedia page of a famous actor and say, they won their Oscar for what? Or their second Oscar in the case of Lee, starring Kate Winslet as Lee Miller, a wonderful actor who seems very connected to this material in many ways, because it's a film about a female camera subject who, as she grew older, became more interested in being less objectified and more of a subject in her field. So Lee Miller was the, as she says in the film in voiceover, model muse ingenue, but also a quite accomplished photographer, even during her time with Man Ray, which the film somewhat elides, even as he was taking a lot of pictures of her that made her a very famous surrealist muse type figure. She was in the dark room with him, which is not really something you would know from the film, in which she sort of has a sort of post-ingenue phase creative breakthrough as a war photographer. This in some ways avoids some of the pitfalls of a biopic, in that it adheres quite tightly to a specific period in this person's life. This is about Lee Miller's during World War II, in which she was a staff photographer for British Vogue and took a lot of pictures of around of the Women's Auxiliary and the nurses and the Blitz, and then was able, after the Normandy invasion, to follow the Allied troops through Europe from Normandy to Paris to Germany to the camps. She took some of the first Western photographs of Dachau and Buchenwald. And so in some ways, it opens up some ideas about the transaction between the person holding the camera and the person who's the subject of the photograph.
There haven't been a lot of good movies about photographers that aren't documentaries.
Yeah, this isn't one, to be clear. And it's a shame, because it's made by the very accomplished cinematographer Ellen Kurist, who shot Eternal Sunshine, Tom Cahillan's Swoon. This is her first fiction feature, although she directed a documentary some years back and has done a lot of television. But I don't think that it is... I was just writing about it this afternoon, and I think that my main issue with it, aside from the fact that this is a biopic in which Lee Miller meets Cecil Beaton and says, "Cecil Beaton, hello." Because that's like, that's just how you introduce a story. But like, that's fine. That thing that happens in these movies. But there's also, I think it is also a film about her. She's a storyteller more so than craftsperson. And the story that she's telling is ultimately her own. So it becomes this very psychologized and personalized, emancipatory study of a woman who found her voice. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, yes, that's been fodder for a lot of great films about artists, but I think it also kind of dodges what's most fascinating about the transition from camera subject to camera to photographer.
Right. Does it do anything with visually?
It doesn't do the shutter click and still thing.
Okay. Does it restage photographs?
Oh, yes, actually. And including some that you wouldn't necessarily expect to, like some candids. I mean, I am a huge sucker for at the end of movies based on true events where they show pictures of the real people. Yeah. Because, wow, that really happened. And now they're all dead. And it just makes me really sad. And it's very beautiful.
Yeah, I don't believe movies unless I have the photos at the end to show me that it happened.
Well, this shows you some things that like didn't seem that important. Actually, there are some things in it that I just happened to discover through reading a random article about her that they don't really emphasize, at least in the film, that are like very closely based on her war correspondences. There's a scene of her in Saint-Malo taking pictures of a firefight and some bombing, where they make up this hotel room that she was in, taking pictures to look. It says there were two soldiers together on a bed in a honeymoon suite, looking at a telescope across the water at their targets, and that's what you see. Huh. And it's not there is some real research that goes into this, but it's also, I should mention that David Sherman, the life photographer, they worked together a lot during the war, and he took the picture of her in Hitler's bathtub. This is a famous photo of Lee Miller when after the Allies arrived in Berlin, and when they were searching for the Führer bunker, they went to Hitler's apartment, and the Allied soldiers were hanging out there, and apparently it was one of the few places in Berlin where you could have a hot bath, and it was Hitler's bathtub, so she... It's a photo of her in Hitler's tub with a picture of Hitler behind her and her boots, which I think were, according to the legend, still had the mud of Dachau on them, on the bath mat in front. And David Sherman took the picture, which she set up. And
she directed.
Which she Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So David Sherman is played by Andy Samberg. And so much of the...
I did not know that.
They have a very very mutually supportive platonic relationship. At one point, she calls him one of the good ones. And
how is she? Which Winslet do we have here?
I would say this is a fairly... I wouldn't say it's super maximalist because she's also carrying a hidden trauma. And as Lee Miller did, and that sort of is reflected in much of her wartime experience. So there's a lot of like heavy signification that something is being concealed, if that makes any sense. So it's a heavily pretentious movie. It's directed by a cinematographer. It's well lit. It's well color graded. Mm-hmm. The Alexandre Desplat score is not bad, but he's a man that we've heard a lot of over the years, and sometimes less is more, but not in this case.
He's got the displatometer.
And I think that like that is, I think it is used as a bit of a crutch.
Well, yeah, we don't have to, but I was curious about that one just because of the subject matter, which maybe we can talk about another film entirely. His three daughters, Azazel Jacobs. People might know what's the best known film of his.
Dahl and M, the TV show with Emily Mortimer. I guess his last one might be the most well-known, French Exit with Michelle Pfeiffer.
His three daughters is about end of life for the father of three women, and they're holed up in his home where he was being taken care of by one of the daughters. And it's really, I mean, it's almost like a play in the sense that that's really almost the entire movie.
Oh, yeah, it is. I mean, it opens with, well, aside from the fact that it's about three sisters, it opens with Carrie Coon in sort of like a rehearsal neutral black turtleneck against a white backdrop, delivering a monologue in a very sort of exaggerated, actorly way.
Mm-hmm.
It is a single set play, and much like in a single set, and takes place mostly in the living room, and the father is off in his bedroom dying. The camera never follows in there. Even the scenes out, I was thinking about this watching the film, I was like, even the scenes that take place outside, like when another of the sisters, Natasha Lyonne, goes out into the courtyard mm-hmm. to smoke a doobie, those scenes with the super that she interacts with, mm-hmm. Who's one of like six or so speaking parts in the film, those scenes would be done downstage in a single spotlight.
Yeah.
And I think that it would be a good play because it's good material. I will tell a sort of digressive but quick anecdote, which is that I did a tossed off tweet. The third sister is played by Elizabeth Olsen, and I did a tossed off mm-hmm. tweet after I saw the film that Elizabeth Olsen delivers a monologue in this movie in which she talks about being a Deadhead and how the Grateful Dead fans are a community of people who look out for each other. And I thought it was funny, and I know like a couple of Deadheads in New York, but the teenage Portuguese or Brazilian Elizabeth Olsen stands like retweeted this en masse, and I was looking at all of the quote tweets, and they're like, if there's one thing Lizzie can do, it's sell a monologue. Go, Lizzie stands, we're eating. And it's really silly, but like, sure, she's a good actress, and there's far more embarrassing things you could be doing on Twitter, but most of them actually, than like, you know, sharing your enthusiasm for like a quite talented actor, but she is eating. It's really good material. It's good material for all three, for the three daughters.
Yeah, it really is. And there's just a constant, like, I mean, it helps also that there's a lot of like simmering resentments and bickering, and that they're constantly setting each other off, basically. A lot of good passive aggression. My favorite is the passive aggressively filled refrigerator.
Oh, yeah. It's also like it's very equitable in its distribution of moments, beats, both at the beginning of the film and the end. Like two people kind of get the end and the other one gets the beginning. And
that's really true.
Yeah, it's very equitable. It's also geographically equitable, too, I think. We talked earlier a little bit about this, about how TIFF has a lot of movies that really require name actors to sort of launch them. And this is the kind of movie that, you know, eventually when it opens in New York, like Natasha Lyonne is going to live at the IFC Center for a week doing Q&As into the wee small hours, because that's how people see these movies. And I was realizing in conversation with some friends that we have Natasha Lyonne, who's a New Yorker. I believe Elizabeth Olsen is in California.
Okay.
And Carrie Coon is a Chicago person.
Right.
So we have all three of the coasts, which is really important if you're going to launch a movie like this for like the Q&As. It's just efficient. Yeah. And I also think to continue with its prospects, because I think that this is the kind of movie that will play to an older skewing art house crowd, which is who turns out for these kinds of TIFF movies. But what is interesting about this, I think, and again, another digressive anecdote.
Wait, just one thing. I'm not sure. I said like the key detail that the father is in hospice at home.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why they've all kind of gathered around him. They have all these undealt with tensions among them, and also tensions about how to deal with their father.
With their father and with each other.
Who is? I mean, this is the connection that there was to what you were just talking about with Lee? Well, this idea of absence, because the father looms large without actually being. As you say, the camera does not go into the room where he is. So people, that's like the fraught off stage for the film, where the sisters periodically disappear to one by one, usually.
Yeah.
But anyway, carry on digressing.
Well, what you're saying really feeds into this, which is especially for an art house audience, an older skewing art house audience. My dad's a lawyer. He does wills and estates and things like that. And I think that the job is wearing on him more than it used to as it gets older and as his three children get older and begin to live our different adult lives. Because what happens sometimes is that one of my dad's clients dies and then he has to watch his dead client's children sue each other.
Right.
And he calls it like the Smothers Brothers thing. Mom always liked you best. And he's joking, but he's also very concerned that, as I think most parents are, that the family that you made and that you will be leaving behind you will not continue on after you're gone. So he's talking to me, and I presume to my brother and sister, a lot about our relationship with each other a lot more than he used to, because I think that that's something that I think as he contemplates his own mortality. So I think he should see this movie, but I also think that it's a movie that like an art house audience will watch this and see themselves sort of in the room off stage. But I think that also, the sort of metaphor for the cohesiveness of the family is that this is also a great movie about New York City real estate and holding on to a lease.
Although the funny thing is that two of the siblings, or especially one of the siblings, Carrie Coon's character, seems to think it's more about that than the other two really do. And what's interesting is also how they're plotting out their individual relationships with each other, one-to-one or as a group, and they have differing views. So there are a lot of kind of rude surprises about the extent or the existence of said relationships, and you know their anxieties about where you are in life for each of them in different ways. But I think the actors transcend any simplification of it. I will say that it sort of wore on me, and it's very hard for me to discern whether that's just, I mean, what it's about, you know. But there is something about Jacobs's approach to like dialogue, and like it's very written, and I kind of appreciate that because I'm kind of sick of dialogue that is trying not to sound written. And of course, yeah, the opening scene, like, you know, going for it. But it just gets kind of chewy or something. I don't know what the word is after a while. It's hard to sustain. I mean, it's really hard to sustain the energy in the room. It sounds like you basically embrace the movie, though.
Yeah, I don't think it's... I think in some ways it's more or less what I expected and resolves in the way that I expected it to. But I think also seeing it at TIFF and thinking that this is, you know, in some ways the platonic ideal of a TIFF movie, I think it's nice, and I enjoyed it. And I think that it is kind of a fascinating meta commentary on a geriatric art house audience, just hoping that, well, to go back to Hayao Miyazaki, you know, I just hope that when I'm gone, my kids will still go to the Angelica.
Well, whether by plan or not, that sounds like a very good way to end the podcast, even though we did have one more movie to talk about.
I would love to hear your take on it, because I think it was more satisfying than mine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think definitely there are a lot of documentaries that, that premiere here that, you know, travel, as is the case with Sundance. I think maybe there's a bit more of, like, I don't know, documentaries that could be magazine features. I mean, not that sure that means anything to anyone anymore.
Documentaries about Nickelback. Paul Simon. There's a four-hour Paul Simon documentary later this festival.
Okay, I thought...
Ominously, it fits my schedule.
I thought that was like a misprint, because I've had a lot of run times that are displaying wrong.
Oh, no, it's definitely that long.
Okay.
I think it must be a TV thing, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean, one example of a movie, of a documentary that kind of upended my expectations as I was watching it is Silver Dollar Road, which is the newest film from Raoul Peck. And I actually happen to be one of the people who actually saw and liked, I guess, Exterminate the Brutes, the strange HBO Max. I don't even know what to call it, but I thought it was astonishing. But I mentioned that series because it's very, like, kind of agitprop, like, deconstruction and retelling of, you know, global imperialist history, and also especially U.S. This movie is about a particular family, but like an extended family in North Carolina, you know, who have had this shore property for a long time. It's part of a whole bunch of land that has been in African-American families for, you know, decades. And yeah, predictably enough, people have been weaseling ways to get the land out from under them. And it basically tracks one sort of a core family, but also the extended members of the family as they're coping with it. And as it's going along, I kept thinking, oh, when is this going to give us like the big picture or something that his previous few documentaries have been doing? And then at a certain point, I realized that that was the great and really smart choice of the movie, is that it's really just digging into the family's emotional reactions, which see them just say, like, I don't know what to do. I'm just completely overwhelmed. I don't even know who to call. You know, they call one attorney after another that just takes advantage of them, fleeces them, and does next to nothing. So that kind of lack of a clear solution was amazing to me, that he, in a sense, as a filmmaker, kind of stays... there's a humility to it, because he's not trying to explain it all somehow, which is a way of kind of trying to get a handle on things, which I understand and I want. But in this case, he just brings us close to their vulnerability, but also their strength. So that was my feeling about it.
I like your read on it a lot. I was frustrated with it. It's based on a ProPublica investigation mm-hmm. that was published in The New Yorker that I read at the time, and that really struck me. The sort of specific mechanism that it is a lens into is a phenomenon like called heir's property, which I will now explain very badly, which is when someone dies intestate and the land passes to a sort of de facto trust controlled by all the heirs equally. And so you can use that to buy, mm-hmm. you can buy somebody out, like a distant cousin, and the land becomes sort of split among, especially with, if it's a large family and a large extended family with multiple generations and far-flung cousins and things like that, it becomes very easy to claim. That's not really explained very well in the movie, but I was waiting for it to become more analytic, but I also, I've read the magazine article, so I guess that's fine. And I live in an Afro-Caribbean part of Brooklyn, and where there's a lot of multi-generational families living together, and I am becoming increasingly aware of things like deed theft, refinancing schemes. And so even though it's a different type of legal mechanism, this film does really speak to that experience of the dream of generational wealth and stability through home ownership and the way that's been undermined. And as you say, it does a really good job of showing the hopes that are built up into that. I think my favorite part of the film is the archival footage of and photographs of the family throughout the... It's not really clear when Raoul Peck came onto this project, and I think it seems like he may have even taken it over from like a ProPublica director or something. There's like some extra stuff credited, and it's based on this article, but there's footage from before the article that seems like documentary. But anyway, there's also a lot of home videos, there's photographs. Apparently there was a dance club there in the 80s that one of the sons ran that
right,
seems really
yeah.
cool.
No, there's
something like a beach, and that it's really beautiful, and that is really exciting to see. And really as my frustrations with the movie as like a piece of either explicit agitprop or pedagogy as they fade and become less specific. I remember the stuff that you're talking about most. So yeah.
Well, I think I'll leave it at that for Silver Dollar Road, which is, I guess, the name of the...
It's the road that goes to the river that goes to the sea.
Yeah. And I mean, also, I guess this also falls in with some of the generational stuff we've been talking about, because one thing is the kind of insecurities of the next generation that wants to be able to rely upon grandparents or an aunt who seems to know things, but everyone grows old, you know, so there's a real poignancy in that as well. But we can maybe leave it there for this edition, this episode. There's more you could say about all of these movies. Once again, these are just initial thoughts. What's the next movie you're going to see?
I am very excited to catch up with a lot of the stuff from the European festivals later this week. I'm going to see The Beast. I'm going to see Evil Does Not Exist. Green Border. All of these exciting fall festival titles that I will... that I'm very excited to see, much more so than I am the next thing that I'm going to see tonight, which I will not mention on this podcast. But you can all read my review of it on Little White Lies, the fine United Kingdom-based film publication through which I am accredited for the Toronto Film Festival.
Yes. So read Mark's writing in Little White Lies. Is there anywhere else for this?
Screen Slate, Art Newspaper...
Everywhere where fine film criticism is published.
Twitter.com. X.
All right. Well, I'll set you free to see this undisclosed movie.
Here's hoping that the next thing you see is even better than the last thing I saw.
And there we have it. You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.